So there's a handout over there. Because I thought we'd spend at least a second thinking about where we've gotten to with our three-dimensional solutions to Schrodinger's equation. So pretty commonly, potentials just depend on distance, not on orientation. So free particles, for example, the hydrogen atom, most importantly, isotropic simple harmonic oscillators. In all those cases, the potential just depends on R. And so we should expect there should be solutions that are just like each other except rotated, and they work just as well. And that invariance to rotation is the degeneracy that is the fact that the solution can be factored into this piece that depends on R and this YLM. And then the equation for R doesn't depend on M. So any old M is going to give you the same value for the energy as you would get for any other possibility. And you might remember that M runs between minus L and plus L. And so there are, if you count them, there are 2L plus 1 possibilities for different orientations of these solutions. So the energy will depend on the total angular momentum, which is what L is, because the equation has a centrifugal potential in it. So larger values of L are going to keep the particle from spending much time in the vicinity of the origin. L equals zero, which is an orbit that's going just in and out, that will spend a large amount of time sitting right on top of the origin. So when we work these things out, it was always the same method, and you should be familiar with this method. So the starting point was to seek dimensionless coordinates, because you can't write down a mathematical equation that's in dimensioned coordinates. So if there is something that's write downable in using functions that they know downstairs, it's going to have to have been in dimensionless coordinates. And in all of these problems, we've been lucky in that there has been a single choice for what to use, for example, for the length of L. Then the plan is to determine, looking at the differential equation, determine the behavior of the function at the extremes, where R goes to infinity, where R goes to zero. And kind of the logic is that in the end, we're going to hope for a polynomial solution, but these equations typically are going to decay exponentially for large values of distance. Right? When we go into classically disallowed regions where the kinetic energy is negative, we have exponentially decaying, tunneling solutions. And exponential decay doesn't match very well to polynomials, so we kind of have to factor it out. So we end up, for example, in the hydrogen atom with things like this, where we have the term that needs to be there to have the function get small in the classically disallowed region. We pretty much always have to have a rho to the L for kind of a subtle reason, maybe. Remember that this is really the Laplacian, if we take it apart. And the Laplacian is going to be the most singular part of the differential equation. It's going to go like 1 over R squared, whereas the potential in the hydrogen atom, it's only singular like 1 over R. And of course, the energy is like a constant. So if we're going to have a solution in the vicinity of R equals zero, it's going to have the Laplacian being zero. And you know that we had solutions last semester of the form R to the L Legendre polynomial, or R to the minus L plus 1 Legendre polynomial. And of course, the latter are singular and so non-normalizable. So unless the potential is highly singular, we're always going to have a rho to the L in our equation for L. So without loss of generality, we can write any imaginable function like this, where h is to be determined. And then the hard part is usually writing down the differential equation for that h, and then seek a polynomial solution for that h, hopefully getting a two-term recursion relation. And using the formula we described, if you have a two-term recursion relation, you can immediately write down the solution in terms of a hypergeometric. And then you can use the hypergeometric as an index to tell you the famous dead physicist whose name is associated with the resulting polynomial. Okay, so if anything works, this is what works. It should always be your first attempt at solving these sort of differential equations. So we did it for the infinite square well. Infinite square well worked really identically to the normal square well in the sense that we have exactly the same formula for energy that we had for the square well, except the roots of sine are obvious, right? The roots are multiples of pi, whereas the roots of the spherical Bessel function are not in general simple, but Mathematica at least knows them, so we can figure out what the energy levels are. So if we look at our plots of the spherical Bessel functions, we can look at where the zeros are, and the first zero corresponds to L equals zero, the next zero out corresponds to L equals one, the next zero out corresponds to L equals two, and then we have the second zero from L equals zero. So that's why we have this ordering of the energy levels. Right? So we have these funny letters that go with angular momentum. We get the first D state before we get the second S state, which is to say that the green zero for L equals two happens just before the second red zero for L equals zero. If we look at the pattern of energy levels, which are more precisely shown in this handout, you might notice that there's no kind of standard spacing. They're kind of all over the place. And that's indicative of a system that doesn't have a frequency. It turns out that the spacing of the energy levels tells you about the frequency of the classical motion, which is basically what got Bohr going. And so in the case of the simple harmonic oscillator, where there is a frequency, we have a spacing. In the case of the hydrogen atom, where different orbits have different frequencies, we again don't have a spacing, but the approximate spacing that we would have for the hydrogen atom would tell you the period of the corresponding classical elliptical orbit. Okay. Now, it's also kind of important to get a handle on what the wave functions look like. And the first kind of important thing to recognize is for the first two cases, I could draw the wave functions on a single plot. Whereas I couldn't do that with the hydrogen wave functions. The hydrogen wave functions extend to pretty big radiuses that, roughly speaking, the radius of these orbits goes like n squared. So if I try and plot n equals 1 and n equals 4 on the same piece of paper, one of them is going to be look really funny. So in order to plot things reasonably, I have to expand the scale as I go out in n. And of course, the reason that that's the case is that there's a really soft boundary, right? The potential that we have for the hydrogen atom is just 1 over r plus centrifugal potential. So if I change this energy by a little bit, I change the classically allowed range and the classically allowed region by a whole lot. So these orbitals have radically different sizes depending upon the value of the principal quantum number. And it's kind of important to keep that formula in mind, which relates the principal quantum number, which is the thing that gives us the corresponding energy, which in the in terms of units values, famously 13.6 electron volts times the charge on the nucleus squared divided by n squared. So there's kind of an important difference to recognize about how we label these states. So this state, for example, quite reasonably is going to be called the second S state. It's going to be called 2S. And so it's going to go. This state, for example, is going to be the first D state. But that's not how we label them with the hydrogen atom. So we label them according to the corresponding principal quantum number. So all of these states are degenerate. They all have the same value of n, namely in that case n equals 3. This one here has L equals 2, and it has an R equals 0. And if we plug and chug, we see that that's going to work. This state here, that has L equals 1. It's a P state. It has an R equals 1. And this guy here, it's the third S state. All of those states are degenerate. And so instead of labeling the states by the value of NR, which is basically what, well, NR plus 1, which is basically what we do for every other problem except the hydrogen atom, we're labeling them according to the principal quantum number. Okay? So how many states are there here that are degenerate? Well, there are three lines for three different states, but remember that each one of those states can have different orientations. In general, 2L plus 1. So there are five states that are sitting there in that first D state, and there are three states that are sitting there in that first P state, and when L equals 0, there's just 1. So there are a total of 9 states in that n equals, in that set of degenerate levels that we would specify by n equals 3. And in general, the number of degenerate levels is n squared, so an easy to remember formula. Okay, and the same sort of degeneracy applies to these states too, right? So this is a D state, so there are actually 5 states with different orientations of the wave functions that have precisely the same energy. Okay. Now it'll be a while before we kind of get to this story, but the way we learn about these energy levels is typically by the light that is emitted when the particle goes from an excited state to a less excited state. So in the case of the hydrogen atom, the states have radically different energy. Let me try and redraw this. I mean, there's a huge difference here between minus a half, minus an eighth, and minus an 18th. So the spacing really goes hugely different for different states. So there isn't a whole lot of difference between a transition like that and a transition like that in terms of the difference in energy. And of course, it's the difference in energy that is determining the frequency of the corresponding light that's emitted when the process occurs. So since, roughly speaking, the wavelength that you get depends on the final state, the name of these sorts of transitions, which famous dead physicist is named for them, depend on the final state, not the initial state. So anything that's going to the ground state of the hydrogen atom is called a Lyman transition. And the longest wavelength, which is to say the lowest frequency, is this guy here, or that guy here. They're degenerate, so they have the same energy, which is called Lyman alpha. And something like this would be called Lyman beta. And Lyman's a relatively recent famous dead physicist, I think 1900s, because this is an ultraviolet transition, so it's difficult to observe. You can't get ultraviolet light through glass, for example. So it's glass being the preferred thing for optics. So it's a little bit tough to observe these ultraviolet transitions. What was observed early on were these transitions, Balmer, 1800s. So this would be the, this one too, would be the, and for that matter, this one too. All of those would have the same energy difference And this would be the smallest energy difference, which is to say the smallest frequency, the longest wavelength. So something like this would be called Balmer alpha. And it's a very prominent, it's a red photon. It's a very prominent transition astronomically. And if we just go up one level, it's kind of a blue-green photon, we would get to Balmer beta. If we go to the next level, transitions between n equals 3 and n equals 2, those are passion, and those are infrared photons. So they're, again, not quite so easy to observe. Okay, so all of these transitions have famous dead physicist names associated with them. And that's really how we would measure these energy levels. We measure energy differences according to the frequency of light that's emitted when we have a corresponding transition. Now, a whole lot can be said, and maybe further, closer to the end of this course, we'll say something about rules which say what transitions are allowed and which ones are not allowed. Favorable transitions and unfavorable transitions. And the only rule I'll mention currently is that we expect L to change even odd sort of behavior. In transitions. So this transition here, which was L equals 0 to L equals 0, actually should not occur. What we should see is this transition from L equals 1 to L equals 0. Okay, so that's the first of many rules for what transitions are allowed. And the other word I want to say is that frequently people will talk about forbidden transitions, and you should not take those words literally. Basically, any transition occurs, it's just a matter of whether it's easily observable or not. So it turns out that basically all of the transitions we observe astronomically are so-called disallowed transitions, forbidden transitions, basically because you can't do them in the laboratory. And the difference between the laboratory and astrophysical conditions is the size of the box that holds the atoms. Right? So typically physical apparatus has to fit in a room, so it's, you know, meter scale. And if an atom bounces off a wall, it'll have a different way of losing energy in addition to losing a photon. Whereas if the wall is light years away, it can sit around for a very long period of time before it bumps into something. And so these so-called disallowed transitions occurred. So the rule is the word disallowed, forbidden, should not be taken literally. It just means unlikely. Difficult to observe in the laboratory, but not literally non-occurring. Basically, any transition will occur if you wait long enough. Questions about three-dimensional problems. It's maybe worth commenting that if you look, I think not in our book, but not uncommonly, if you look at wave functions in books, they won't look a lot like this. And that's because pretty commonly people plot U as opposed to capital R. And the reason they do that is kind of to take out the fact that if we have a radial oscillation, it automatically has to have a bigger amplitude when it goes to smaller r, because there's less surface area. So if you want to make something that looks more regular, that doesn't get big at r equals 0, then you plot u. But it's kind of not the physical quantity, right? R really tells you the density of probability, and so it's the one that's really, really relevant. And you can see, for example, like this simple harmonic oscillator function, I don't know, it looks a little bit weird, right? Because it has a very big amplitude at the origin. But again, that's to be expected. If it has a radial oscillation, all of the stuff is getting concentrated right at the origin. So we should expect big probabilities there. It may come as a surprise to think that for the hydrogen atom, the singular most likely place to find the electron is right on top of the nucleus. Right? That's where this function, which is the ground state, has its maximum. The largest possible probability density sits on top of the nucleus. And the electron happily goes right through the nucleus, right? There's no particularly strong interaction besides the electrostatic interaction for those guys. It is important to keep in mind the huge range difference between these two. So roughly speaking, the size of a nucleus compared to the size of a hydrogen atom is in the ratio of 1 to 100,000. So there's almost always the electron is outside of the nucleus, which may contradict the statement that the highest probability density is on the nucleus, right? But there's so much other volume outside of the nucleus that it very much outweighs the higher probability. But that also shouldn't take away the fact that the electron happily moves through the nucleus unconcerned. If we look at larger values of Z, look at uranium as opposed to hydrogen, then the corresponding wave functions are getting concentrated. And so in uranium, roughly speaking, the range difference that was a factor of 100,000 is now something like a factor of 100, which is still a pretty big size difference. If we replace the electron by a muon, which we can do, then we get situations where the charged particle, the lepton, the muon, is in fact spending the majority of its time inside the nucleus. You know, happily traveling inside the nucleus without any special bumping into something or not, right? Nucleus is just a bunch of charge. There's no reason you can't be inside the nucleus. Okay, questions on hydrogen atom? Well, so our picture of the hydrogen atom has lots of things that need to be improved over time. And the first one that confused things for a long time, we now resolve in what's called electron spin. So to start off, let's just think about any old spin, right? So if we look at a methane molecule, for example, it can certainly rotate about its center of mass. And it's an isotropic molecule, so it has equally sized moment of inertia tensors. And so the corresponding energy is just the angular momentum squared divided by 2 times that moment of inertia. So that's an isotropic, a spherically symmetric molecule. If we had a molecule that was not spherically symmetric, a tennis racket, for example, which has 3 different moments of inertia, you learned in mechanics that the corresponding statement when you have unequal moments of inertia is more complicated and you get more complicated behaviors. But, you know, so it goes. So if we're thinking about a spinning, and let's think about a spinning isotropic molecule like methane, if we think about spin, how can things be different, right? Well, we could up the total angular momentum, the spin rate of that molecule, or we could have that molecule spinning in different orientations. If we want to go in that direction, though, we're going to need new coordinates, right? Because we have coordinates of the center of mass of this molecule, and then we have to have additional coordinates, angular coordinates, that are going to specify the orientation of that molecule. So we're going to have operators that depend on those internal coordinates. And it turns out you can solve this problem, and it's the usual YLM, but now theta and phi aren't referring to the location of the center of mass, they're referring to the orientation of this guy. So we can have a guy that's spinning around the z-axis, or we can change its orientation, and so we're going to have lots of degenerate states where that molecule is rotating in different directions. Okay, so all of this is doable, has been done to figure out, we're actually not going to do it because if you remember from mechanics, rotation is kind of an ugly subject in terms of things like the Euler angles. But the main point I want to make here is that electron spin is in some sense not fundamentally different from the same sort of spin. And I want to say the reverse of that, that electron spin is fundamentally different from these other sorts of spin. So Bohr famously said that the sign of a great idea is that both it and its complement, its reverse, are true statements. So what's different about electron spin compared to a spinning molecule of methane? Well, at least approximately speaking, what's different is that I can't make it spin faster or slower. I can have different orientations, I can have different m values, but I can't change the L, the total angular momentum. And incidentally, since we want to now distinguish orbital angular momentum from this other type of angular momentum, we're usually going to use S to indicate the total amount of spin angular momentum. So there's a subtle point that, I don't know, makes this statement either true or false, that has to do with kind of how we name things. So a spinning methane molecule we still call a methane molecule. What would a spinning hydrogen atom be like? Well, it just means we have one more unit of angular momentum, right? So we could call, say, this state the lowest energy state that has one unit of angular momentum to be a spinning hydrogen atom, right? It doesn't seem quite fair because it's not rigidly rotating. But technically speaking, the methane molecule isn't rigidly rotating either. That is to say, those hydrogens can vibrate, those bonds can stretch. We can actually measure the stretch of those bonds due to the centrifugal force if we have high spin rates. But approximately speaking, at least, the methane molecule can be thought of as a rigid object, whereas the hydrogen atom is not at all rigid. But we would still call that a hydrogen atom. So how about a proton? So in contrast to an electron, a proton is a composite particle, just the way a hydrogen atom is a composite particle, right? So proton is made out of three quarks, two ups and a down quark. And it turns out that those quarks have angular momentum, and the angular momentum of the quarks is what gives us the angular momentum of the proton. If I change the angular momentum of the quarks, still have exactly the same quark content, two ups and a down, but I just change how much angular momentum they have, we don't call it a proton anymore. We call it something else. For example, we call it a delta particle. And the reason we give it a new name has to do with history, and it has to do with basically the mass-energy relationship. The energy that's involved in changing the angular momentum of those up and down quarks is large compared to the total energy of a proton. So a delta particle, where all we've done is to switch the spins of the quarks, actually weighs about 30% more than a proton. And so as a result, historically it was given a different name and will always be given a different name, I guess. So just because it's an excited state, the excited state is so excited that equals mc squared leads to a large mass difference between them. The result is given, we give the particle a new name. In some sort of theoretical sense, one might guess that the muon is just an excited state of the electron. But this would be in a context of a theory no one has worked out. So in the context of string theory, which is not a theory that actually does anything, just a cloud in the sky that might work someday, my guess is no. But in any case, with such a theory, maybe the muon would just be an excited state of the electron, with the constituents being just given more, just being in an corresponding excited state. Okay, so what's the upshot of this? Well, the upshot of this is kind of complicated. For chemists, they don't want to come up with new names for methane when it's spinning or when it's not spinning. So it's all methane, just spinning or not. For protons, whether we give the proton some angular momentum, we make it spin faster or not, we do give it a new name. We call it a delta particle. For the electron, there is no candidate. That is to say, there is no evidence. We don't know of any particle that fits the bill of an electron that's spinning faster. So it sure seems like we can't change the spin of the electron. So there's another important difference between spinning methane and a spinning electron, and that is for a spinning methane molecule, we could actually measure those internal coordinates that are involved in the angular orientation of the methane molecule. So for example, if the methane molecule is spinning quickly, the hydrogen atoms are going to be experiencing Doppler shifts of radiation that might, for example, be involved in nuclear magnetic resonance. So we can actually measure the internal coordinates that are rotating. With the electron, there is no current experiment that has a handle on any internal coordinate. So we could write down wave functions that depend on internal coordinates, but why bother if we can't actually measure them? We might as well just lump them together into some sort of thing. So I can talk about a wave function. So I guess I haven't actually said this. Another kind of funny situation about the electron is that its angular momentum isn't an integer, it's a half integer. Remember, we said that it was a requirement that 2L plus 1 be an integer, but that left open the possibility that L could be a non-integer. One can show that for orbital angular momentum, it does have to be an integer, but this isn't orbital angular momentum. It doesn't have to be an integer, and in fact, the spin of the electron and the spin of the proton and the spin of lots of other things is in fact a half. So that there are two states, one that has an m value that is in the positive direction and another one that has an m value that is in the negative direction. So we might call that ms and we might call that s. And just as with these states, m can go between l and minus l, s can go between minus s and plus s, but there are only two steps. So there are only two possible states, so-called spin up and spin down, for the corresponding spinning electron. And I say, if we really wanted to, we could write down functions for those things that would be kind of like YLMs, but if we can't actually measure those angles, why bother, right? We can just deal with these things as an orthonormal basis. And we can happily calculate things without benefit of the internal angles. In fact, the internal angles, of course, just make everything more complicated. We have to do integrals, and the plan is not to do integrals, to just use things like the raising and lowering operators to tell us what the integral would be if we bothered to do this. Okay, so some other notation, we can call this guy logically spin up and that guy logically spin down. Not uncommonly, people use like alpha and beta for these two things. I mean, all we really need are two distinct things. And if you want, you can say that there are internal orientation variables that would be in terms of the function that those things are, but there really isn't any reason to actually go about doing that. Okay, so what are the equations we have for the corresponding spin operators? So we said that the eigenfunctions, the eigenvalues of L squared were h bar squared L plus 1. And so corresponding to that, the total spin angular momentum is going to be h bar squared SS plus 1. So if we put in our 1 half, we've got that for our corresponding value of S squared. And this value of S squared it's the same eigenvalue for both the upstate and the downstate. And both of those are eigenfunctions of the total angular momentum squared. And we can write the corresponding matrix then as being, right, where we can call this thing here the state that is 1, 0, and this thing here the state that is 0, 1. And if I do my matrix multiplication, that guy gives me exactly the same results. In terms of the angular momentum in the z direction, and this takes so much work to write, I'm going to go to the simplified notation. So if I let Sz operate on that state, I'm going to get the corresponding angular momentum, which is h bar half, times that same thing back. And if Sz operates on the state that's down, I'm going to get minus h bar times a half times spin down. So the corresponding matrix is going to be h bar over 2, like that. It does the same thing, right? When I operate on, for example, the upstate, I get exactly h bar over 2 times the upstate, right? Exactly like that. Okay, so we showed that we had raising and lowering operators, and those things, for example, when operating on LM, gave us h bar square root of L plus 1 minus M plus or minus 1, and then we got back, either we raised or lowered the state accordingly. And this guy was LX plus minus I LY. Okay, well, we will soon use the fact that LX is therefore 1 half L plus L minus, and LY is going to be 1 over 2 I L plus minus L minus. But let's first work out what this result is. So what we have then is S plus operating on the upstate is going to give me 0. And S plus operating on the downstate is going to give me the upstate. And then it's going to give me, this is going to give me again 3/4. m is equal to minus a half. So I have minus a half plus a half, which is plus one, which is going to give us 1/2. So I've got 1. Okay, so it just turns out that this is a nice number as opposed to usually an ugly number. And what this means is that the matrix that represents S plus is going to take a state that is in the down level and give us a corresponding up level, right? So you see that if I multiply this by the up level, I get 0. If I multiply this by the down level, I in fact get the up level. Okay? Okay, one more thing to do. How about if S minus operates on the up state? It's going to give us the down state. And what we're going to have then is, so this is S minus, so we're going to have 1/2. 1 minus 1 is going to give us minus a half. So we're going to get, again, 3/4 plus a quarter. Square root of that is 1. So we're just going to give h bar. And of course, S minus operating on the down state, it's going to annihilate it because there's nothing lower. So the matrix that represents S minus is that, right? Because if I have it operate on the up state, I get the down state. If I have it operate on the down state, I get 0. Okay, so then SX is going to be 1/2 the sum of those two guys. So that's going to give us 0, 1, 0, 1. And SY is going to give us the difference and the plus 1. Did I erase it? No, I didn't. I have to get the order right. So that we have a plus 1 here and a minus 1 there. And let me write SZ here. Oops. Like that. And historically, this guy is written a little bit differently. We'll put the I inside. And we'll get that. So these matrices, those things have the form that S vector is equal to H bar over 2 times a matrix. And these things are called the Pauli spin matrices. Well, let's check out what we're doing, right? So the commutation relations have to still hold. And maybe before we do this, let me remind you that if we really wanted to, we could write these things that I'm just writing as arrows really are, if you want, internal, would be functions of the internal coordinates that would deal with the orientation of the electron. But we can't measure the internal orientation of electrons. So why bother to write these functions? All we really need to know is that these are an orthonormal set, and then we don't have to do the integrals, right? We can just use those facts. So these things that are just arrows are really telling us the orientation of the corresponding electron, but it's a whole lot simpler just to deal with the arrows. Okay, so you might remember that we had commutation relations like that, one of many. Let's check to make sure that this is still true of these guys. So when we multiply Sx by Sy, we're going to get this factor out front squared. And then we're going to get 0, 1, 1, 0 times 0 minus I, 0 minus 0 minus I, I, 0 times 0, 1, 1, 0. Right? So all of these things that are true of the operators still have to be true of the matrices. So let's see how this works out. So what I get here is an I there, 0 there, 0 there, and I get a minus I there. And here I get a minus I there, 0, 0, and here I get an I. So with this minus sign, those two guys are the same. So what I've got is h bar squared over now just 2. And let's pull out the I, 1, 0, 0, minus 1, which I hope you recognize is h bar times I sz. Just the way it's supposed to be. Matt, you're looking unhappy. You're happy enough? Okay, so these little arrows and these matrices represent, if we were crazy, differential operators, and we could be doing all of this stuff, but why bother? Right? There's no particular reason to do that. Okay, so what I've been claiming so far is that we can consider the spin to be just like a spinning methane molecule, the only difference being that A, we can't make the electron spin faster, and B, instead of having integer angular momentum, it has half integer angular momentum, and C, we can't actually measure these internal coordinates, so why bother with them? Well, it's maybe a little bit more interesting and complicated than that, because there's an additional fact about electron spin, or in fact any fundamental particle spin, is that it kind of comes out automatically from relativity. So if we write down the relativistic Schrodinger equation for an electron, it turns out that we don't have to put in that the electron could be spinning, it comes out automatically. It all works out just from the theory of relativity. So another perfectly true statement is electron spin is a consequence of relativity, and that an electron couldn't be not spinning, in contrast to a methane molecule, which of course could spin or not spin. So take your pick. It's just like a spinning methane molecule with internal coordinates we can't measure, or it's an internal variable that is a consequence of relativity. Two equally good statements. Historically, the spinning aspect, of course, kind of came first, but there are oddities which I probably will mention in a second, that mean that the spinning electron really is different from a spinning methane molecule. And for a while, things were confused. That's kind of the bottom line. There were factors of two that went thither and yon. And one of those rare cases where nature was being really tricky and making things look like X when they were, in fact, kind of like Y. So it took a while to find Z that could distinguish those characteristics. So how can we distinguish between an electron that's spinning up and an electron that's spinning down, right? Just as we had those 2L plus 1 degenerate hydrogen atom states, what does it matter? What does it matter that there are two states, one with a spin up and one with a spin down? Well, a priori, it doesn't make a lot of difference. You'll learn next semester in statistical mechanics that the existence of extra states affects various thermodynamic properties, but that's a kind of a subtle argument that I can't make quite yet. How about other sorts of ways? Well, if we think about it literally as a spinning charged particle, as opposed to just a consequence of relativity, then it corresponds to an electrical current. And something that is an electrical current should have a corresponding magnetic dipole moment. And if we have a magnetic dipole moment, you remember from last semester, in a magnetic field, there's a corresponding potential energy that is minus the magnetic dipole moment dotted into B. Right? Just as if there were an electric dipole moment, the electric dipole would want to be oriented in the direction of E. The magnetic dipole moment, the low energy state, is where the magnetic dipole moment is oriented parallel to B. So if we call B in the Z direction, then there's going to be a high energy state where the electron is oriented in the, I have to be a little bit careful because, for the time being, let the electron be positively charged. It makes everything simpler. So we have the electron then spinning so that its spin is oriented away from the magnetic field being the high energy state, and we have a low energy state where it's spinning in the other direction. And then we can measure, right? So we have two states, this guy where the electron is spinning that way, this way where the electron is, typically we think about the magnetic field being in the up direction. So this is the low energy state, this is the high energy state. There's some energy difference, which we could then measure potentially by looking for photons that would come when the electron goes from spin up to spin down. Okay, this energy should be proportional to the magnetic field. And this is behind what's called electron spin resonance, which is a technique that physicists use to figure out the gyromagnetic ratio of the electron, and then chemists have taken over for chemical purposes. The analogous statements about a proton would be nuclear magnetic resonance. It's an important chemical technique. Okay, so let's start to work out these details because we can measure this energy difference. And let's see how it's going to work out. So first of all, let's make about the simplest possible model we could. Let's think about an electron as making a current that has some radius r. And you might remember the formula for the magnetic dipole moment was the current times the area. So our area here is going to be pi r squared. And our current is going to be the charge on an electron divided by the time it takes to go around in a circle. Okay, so pretty simple model. How about the angular momentum? So the angular momentum is, I should guess use S for spin angular momentum. The angular momentum should be the mass times the perpendicular velocity times the radius. And the velocity we could calculate because it would be the distance that it's traveled, 2 pi r, divided by a period. So here we've got m 2 pi r squared over t, and here we have e pi r squared over t, and you can see that they're related, right? They both have this same factor. So the magnetic dipole moment should be e divided by 2m times the corresponding angular momentum. So this is a very simple argument, but let me tell you that if you run classical mechanics perfectly, you get exactly the same answer. So even though we had lots of simplifying assumptions, this is what you get. So this is sometimes called the gyromagnetic ratio, but you might notice it's actually the magnetogyro ratio. Sorry about that, but that's typically what it's called. And it's wrong. So we can actually measure this energy difference, and it turns out it doesn't follow classical mechanics. It's twice as big as what it should be. If you want to get into details, it's about twice as much and then a hundredth more than it should be. But pretty accurately, twice as much. And this is one place that relativity comes to bear. It turns out that, remember I said that relativity, if you just write down Schrodinger's equation relativistically, you don't have to put in the spin, it comes automatically, and you automatically get the right answer. You don't have to put in the gyromagnetic ratio, you get what's called the G factor of 2 automatically, which again hints that the relativistic explanation is in some sense truer than the spinning particle representation. But I think they're both worth thinking about. Okay, so let me briefly comment that what comes next is, I think, the worst part of the course, the hardest part to understand, and that is that it's total angular momentum that's going to be conserved. And so we're going to be concerned with adding together the orbital angular momentum of the electron to the spin angular momentum of the electron. And that turns out to be kind of a mess. An interesting mathematical problem that is kind of a mess, but is required. Crops up in lots of different situations. And let me also tell you that there's a famous experiment. Einstein's name is on it. I forget the second name that's on it. So let's let this be a piece of iron. If I put this piece of iron in a magnetic field, what's going to happen is the iron is going to magnetize, right? The spins are going to be oriented along this direction. But if the spins change direction, that changes their angular momentum. And you know that angular momentum has got to be conserved. So the angular momentum that it takes to orient these electrons this way has to come from something else. And it comes from the thing physically spinning the other way. A measurable phenomena. Put a piece of iron in a magnetic field. Angular momentum requires the spin angular momentum of the electrons to actually come from someplace, and it'll come from the bulk angular momentum of the sample. So this is an argument for S not being just a simple relativistic glitch, right? It seems to actually connect up to angular momentum the way we think about it classically. Sorry about the overtime.